Ulrich Zwingli. Okay, so we're going to do about 50 or 60 slides here in a couple of minutes. Just to kind of review what we're doing here. Okay, so why do we study church history? Well, the most obvious reason is so that we can learn from it, in terms of things we ought to be doing and things we ought not to be doing. But also it's important for anybody to know why they're doing what they're doing. Now, that is especially true in the second class in this series because we're going to reach the point by tomorrow where we're talking about the history of our movement. Greg and I are both going to cover that. All right. And so a lot of what we do, we think it's because it's in the Bible, but in fact, it's really because of our religious heritage, traditions, things that we assume are the right way to do it. All right. And also to avoid swinging the pendulum. All right. I was just in our MRE cohort. I was just having a discussion with somebody. This brother said, I've been way over here. So basically said, that's why I'm going way over here. And I said, well, I'm the teacher in this class, and I'm telling you, it's my job to help you avoid swinging the pendulum.
Yeah, please.
All right? And so I think that's important. So I talked a little bit about the very early church. Are the things done by the very early church somehow prescriptive for us? The answer is no. Then we talked about the growth of the early church. We talked about how the early church evolved into something that is barely recognizably Christian, right? And we talked about schisms, heresies, false doctrines that came into the church. And yet, what we now call the Catholic Church, the Orthodox Church, the Jacobite Church, the Coptic Church, both of these have a straight line of connection to the very early church. And in all these controversies over false doctrines, they took the right turn. They took the right turn every time, and they ended up in the wrong place. It's because they allowed themselves to gradually drift. And they began to accept tradition as if it was authoritative, and it essentially destroyed, in many ways, the church. Okay, we talked about some of the early schisms. And remember that quiz question? There you go. Arius, the Arians. All right, these were people who basically denied the deity of Jesus. And sort of, there's the pendulum swing in a sense going on in this theology, the doctrine of God and the doctrine of Christ. On the one hand, you have docetism, which is the idea that Jesus only appeared to be in a body. We have modalism, the idea that there's really only one God and three different sort of aspects of that same God. And then you have tritheism, the idea of three completely separate persons. And throughout this early time, what the Orthodox Church, what the mainstream church was trying to do was to protect the mystery. And every single time somebody would say, this is true, and say, no, that's probably not true. But they were forced to make statements that probably they didn't want to make. One substance, three persons, this kind of stuff. All right. But anyway, our commonly accepted theology of God, our commonly accepted theology of Christ was worked out in the 3rd, 4th, and 5th century, really 4th and 5th century, through these church councils. So, for example, at Nicaea, they said that God exists in three entities, persons, hypostases, but only one substance, homoousis. Okay, and then by Chalcedon, they decided that Jesus was fully God and fully man from the very beginning. Okay, and The Eastern Church tended to want to make God, Jesus more God and less man. The Western Church tended to make Jesus more man and less God. And those are the kind of things that went on. Okay, great. And then we talked about orthodoxy versus orthopraxy, heterodoxy versus heteropraxy. Let's see if we got those words down. What is heterodoxy? False teaching or false doctrine. And what is heteropraxy?
False practice.
So the Roman Orthodox and Coptic churches, which was their bigger problem? Heteropraxy.
Yes.
And what we're going to find out is during the Reformation, the Reformers restored orthopraxy, but they did not restore orthodoxy. I'm going to claim, as we learn about the Reformation, that the Catholic Church probably is more orthodox than most Protestant churches. Okay? And so a lot of these criticisms of Catholicism are well aimed, but you know what? Our Baptist friends, our Presbyterian friends, have a big plank in their eye. And, you know, which is more important, correct belief or correct practice? Well, you know,
belief, though, leads to practice.
Okay, there you go. So, I mean, it depends on what you mean by practice.
Right.
All right, because, you know, watch your life and your doctrine, right? Your practice is not necessarily your life. Got it? All right, your life is how you're being like Jesus in your character. And correct practice has to do with the external things primarily. Anyway, good. So we saw some ways that the church drifted. Remember that word in that little quiz we were going to do? The catechumen. All right, and so the drift in doctrine about salvation, the idea of sacerdotalism. There's a big word. Sacerdotalism. Anybody? Take a shot? Greg, you can bail him out if you want. How about sacramentalism? Okay.
I know.
Yeah, Greg's going to bail you out, but he's letting you hang for just a minute here. Right. So the idea of sacramentalism is salvation is through an outward act. That salvation is gained not through Christ, but through the church.
Right.
Ex opere operato. So the sacrament operates in and of itself apart from faith. And so basically, especially the Catholic Church, but the Orthodox Church as well, sort of made itself the source of salvation as opposed to Jesus. Sacerdotalism is the idea of a priesthood. So the idea that the Lord's Supper is a reenactment of a sacrifice, or even that it is in fact a sacrifice itself. So we have priests who perform a role of providing for justification and redemption. All right, when I think probably the only priest we need is
Jesus.
All right. So sacramentalism is essentially creating an earthly priesthood. I'm sorry, sacerdotalism, and then sacramentalism is this system which really destroyed the church. And we're going to find out that this reliance on sacramentalism is really what produced the Reformation, and that was probably a good thing.
And I just want to underscore that, guys. Learn those words because that is the false doctrine of Catholicism. Those are the foundational, you know, departure of that. That's why priests are so exalted. Like in the hospital, a Catholic would call for a chaplain, but when I'd show up, they'd turn me away because of this
sacerdotalism, or whatever, however you say it. I'm sure I'm not saying it right either. So
because they hold these keys to the kingdom, you know, they believe they're it's all through Peter. So that's huge, as well as the church is the holder of grace. That grace is extended through sacraments, period. And so if you get through the sacraments, you're going to heaven, even if you're a gangster in the mafia killing people. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, there are Catholic documents where they advise even baptizing an unconscious person.
Right.
Oh, my goodness.
Literally. Baptize an unconscious person because they made baptism into a sort of a hocus pocus magic formula. I should have been on this slide when I was going through this stuff. Asceticism, creed, sacerdotalism, sacramentalism, and then there are hermeneutic issues as well. Okay, great. We talked about creeds. We'll talk quite a bit about creeds because to some extent the Reformation was all about creating these creeds, the Westminster Creed, and in the Creed of Dort, we talked about hanging out by the sidewalk over there. Okay, got it. Lessons from the early church: avoid convenient but unscriptural organizational structure, resist the trend towards over-ritualization. All right, don't overreact to false doctrines, avoid relying on creeds to defend our faith, do not overemphasize the importance of physical sacrifice. As, in other words, it doesn't make you more saved than you were. Okay, got it? And watch for the tendency to develop a clergy-laity division, which I believe our movement has a significant problem with, honestly. And stress good methods of Bible study. All right, early church writings, the doctrine of the Trinity. Tertullian formulated what we now call the doctrine of the Trinity. He came up with the word. He came up with the idea of one substance, three persons. The terminology is very tricky here. What's interesting is you had Greek and Latin terms, and they're not exactly the same. And so some of the arguments were between Latin and Greek speakers. In fact, well, as you know, the church divided over Latin versus Greek culture. All right. Anyway, origin, we saw that. All right. It's funny because you can see people with their legs going that way, and I don't know, there's somebody with legs there, but there's nobody between those two guys. I don't know, that's a very bizarre thing there. Okay, persecutions, Constantine, church councils. Okay, Nicaea is the most famous. Actually, the Nicene Creed was not produced at Nicaea. Did you know that? The Nicene Creed was produced at the Council of Constantinople. And basically, Constantinople is where they included the Holy Spirit, essentially. They kind of... there was kind of like almost like a di-theism as opposed to a tri-theism before Constantinople. Ephesus is where they begin to work on the doctrine of Jesus. By Chalcedon, the doctrine of Jesus was fully formed. There's nothing that I know of in the statement of Chalcedon that I have any disagreement with whatsoever. I don't like using creeds, honestly, but really... I'd say probably more good than bad, honestly, in the process by which these creeds were created. Then you get monophysitism, monothelitism, one will, one nature, all this sort of stuff. Okay, great. Nicene Creed. You think?
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Hello.
All right. These are some of these heretical teachings that we talked about. I think I mentioned the Church of the East.
Right.
The Church of the East was Nestorian. The Church of the East overemphasized the humanity of Jesus over his deity. The Monophysites overemphasized his deity over his humanity. By the way, what church today is Monophysite? No, this is an ancient church. All right, so I'll give you a hint. This church massively overstresses the deity of Christ and very, very much minimizes the humanity of Christ. Man, you're on a roll. That's good. The Coptic Church.
The caffeine's kicking in.
All right, Coptic Church, which is headquartered where? I was there just a few weeks ago. All right, in Egypt and Ethiopia. All right. Anyway, These are the different councils. Okay, Constantinople is where the idea of one substance, three natures. And it's these guys, Basil, Gregory, and John, who began to basically elucidate Christology. This is the doctrine of God. This is the doctrine of Christ. Okay? And these two schools were constantly fighting it. Are we going to be more human? Are we going to be more godlike? Okay? All right. Ephesus condemned Nestorianism. It's swinging towards God, you know, more deity. Condemned Pelagius. Ah. Do you remember who Pelagius is?
The opponent of Augustine.
On what major doctrine?
Free will.
The doctrine of free will versus predestination. Okay, and by the way, at the end of the day, we're going to be predestinationists. Why do we have to be predestinationists? Because of what important document? Starts with a B. With five letters, the Bible. All right, predestination is a biblical teaching. Calvinism is not. Okay, this hypostatic union, this is fully God, fully man, 100%. One person, two natures. All right, one person, two natures. Fully human, fully divine. You might be surprised to know, in the first or second century, most Christians wouldn't have even had the words to say that. All right? Good. All right, so there it is. This is the Council of Chalcedon. It's in the notes. Without confusion, without change, without division, without separation. All right, other councils, Augustine. Now, in order to understand the Reformation, you've got to get Augustine. Because I'm telling you, what the Reformers did, they did not return Christianity to the primitive theology. They returned Christianity to Augustine. Now, we learned about Thomas Aquinas. Okay, we learned about Thomas Aquinas, what was that, 2 months ago now? Almost 3 months ago? And Thomas Aquinas corrected Augustine. Thomas Aquinas moved the Catholic Church back in a healthier direction from Augustine. Because Augustine was a total double predestination, harsh, total depravity, blah, blah, blah. Okay, and Thomas Aquinas shifted the Catholic Church to a healthier balance between free will and God's sovereignty. All right, so it turns out that Luther, Calvin, and Zwingli went in the wrong direction. They went back towards Augustine. Got it? Augustine, he didn't invent the idea of original sin, but he gave it theological support. He virtually created the idea of predestination, at least the kind that we're talking about, the kind of double predestination. He didn't invent sacramentalism, but he was the one who made sacramentalism a Catholic theologically supported idea. Okay, the idea that the salvation is found not through the righteousness of the person, but through the church. Okay, transubstantiation, that's going to really be a big issue when we get to the Reformation. Anybody remind us what transubstantiation is?
It's the idea that the communion becomes the physical body of Christ.
Right, and Jesus said, "This is my body," didn't he? And Martin Luther, in this colloquy of Marburg, is going to say, "This is my body." And he basically drew a line in the sand. And he says, "I don't care what you say. I'm going to go with the Bible. It says, this is my body." Now, by the way, Martin Luther didn't believe in transubstantiation. He believed in what we're going to call consubstantiation. But don't worry about that yet. We'll get to that later. All right, you have the Immaculate Conception. Now, the Donatists. The Donatists disagreed with Augustine over sacramentalism. The Donatists believed if a priest was unrighteous, then he shouldn't be a priest. All right? And so the Catholic priests who had offered sacrifice to the emperor in the great persecution, they said they can't be a priest anymore. Augustine said, yes, they can, because what they do has nothing to do with whether they're righteous or not. Okay? And of course, as you know, he reacted against Pelagius. And again, there's this common theme that, let's say, here's where you ought to be. Let's just say, here's where you ought to be. But let's say you're over here. So somebody goes over here. Can everybody look up for a second? Because it can be hard. All right, so here's where you ought to be. Here's who you are. So your enemy goes over here. So what do we tend to do? We go, no, we go. It happens every time. All right, so in other words, they say, I'm not going to be like that person, so I'm going to go in the other direction. And even in a conversation I had just yesterday with a friend, he basically said, that's the way I was forever, so I'm going to be like this. I said, bro, let's just look at the Bible and find out where we ought to be, not allow what we were to define what we're going to be. All right, so the bottom line is, Augustine grossly exaggerated what Pelagius taught. And Augustine created Pelagianism, sort of as a straw man. But in the process, Augustine went much, much more harshly towards a total overemphasis on the sovereignty of God and on double predestination, all that kind of stuff. Okay? Anyway, so there you go. Augustine, total depravity, monergism. Anybody? Monergism? That's an important word. Monergism is going to come up. It means one of something. One energy, I guess, right? One energy. Basically, it says all the impetus towards our salvation comes from only one place. And if you're Augustine, where is that total impetus coming from? From who? From God, or Jesus, right? In other words, we have no role in it. The opposite of monergism, by the way, is not diergism. The opposite of monergism is synergism. S-Y-N. Right, not S-I-N, that's for sure. Thank you. Sin meaning together, okay? And so if we are, a Pelagius would be a synergist, I guess. Sort of pretty far in that direction. So a monergism is the idea that it's all of God and none of us whatsoever. That the person who believes in total depravity, is going to be a monergist. You know about predestination, original sin, infant baptism for salvation, second ministry, transubstantiation, all this sort of stuff. Now this is a very, very key thing. Most of these things were already kind of around before Augustine, and Augustine gave him theological support, but the brand new thing is the whole idea of city and state. So he wrote this book called The City of God, in which he proposed that there should be this ideal Christian state. This is Christendom. And the idea of Christendom is the worst thing that ever happened to Christianity, probably. So basically, the job of the state is to defend the church and to impose punishment for those who not obey the church. Okay? And you had Christendom in both East and West. In the East, the state predominated and the church was weaker. In the West, the church predominated and the state was weaker, because in the East you had Byzantium, the Eastern Roman Empire, still a fairly strong holdover from the Roman Empire. In the West, you have almost complete utter chaos, and the unifying force was the church. So therefore, the political power of the church became huge. You have a thing like a pope. You never got a pope in the East. You got a patriarch, but not a pope. Okay? All right, this is all just a bunch of reviews, so I can afford to go through this pretty quickly. There's our friend Pelagius. Did Pelagius teach work salvation? If you ask him, he'd say definitely not. Well, did he or did he not? I don't know. I mean, it probably depends on which thing that he wrote. But we don't have very much that he wrote. Almost everything written about Pelagius was things people said about him. Anyway, I guess it doesn't really matter. It's between him and God right now. Question?
Did we talk about him 3 months ago?
Absolutely. Again, Augustine, the Donatists on sacramentalism, and Augustine and Pelagius on salvation. All right? And so basically the idea of who has a part in our salvation. Okay? So Pelagius, I believe, was closer to the truth than Augustine, for sure. He rejected original sin. I believe Pelagius was a semi-Pelagian. Right? In other words, he did not fully say that we can become perfect. By the way, John Wesley was accused of being a Pelagian because John Wesley really, 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 really stressed the idea that we need to become holy. And it's sometimes called the sanctification church, essentially, the Methodist church. But anyway, John Wesley and Pelagius would have a fair amount in common. All right, soteriology. This is the study of how we are saved, right? In the East, God becoming flesh allowed us to become like God. They stress deification. In the West, Jesus being crucified as a substitutionary sacrifice for sins. So in the East, the incarnation is the key thing. And the West, the cross is the key thing. All right? And probably, if you combine the East and the West, you have a healthy theology. Okay? Now, Greg's into cross theology,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
He is. But Greg would understand the importance of God becoming flesh.
Yes, incarnate.
Right. He
you
could
can't have a cross.
He couldn't become. He couldn't save what he didn't become.
Right.
He is our perfect priest.
Yeah.
All right. Hebrews 4:5. Yeah.
So why couldn't they just go yes and yes?
I would say the mindset of the West and the mindset of the East are totally different. Rome is all about law. I mean, Rome created the greatest legal system, the greatest empire in history. The Greeks were about philosophy. So to them, Plato and Aristotle, they're going to go in that direction. And to them, God needs to be separate and distant. And in our theology class, we got this whole, the economic Trinity versus the imminent Trinity. Now, this whole distinction goes back to this Greek idea. So this Greek idea is still infecting theology today, in my opinion. But okay, great. Ambrose, Jerome, extreme asceticism, especially in the East. Asceticism was a much bigger deal in the East, but eventually became a really big deal in the West as well. All right, we talked about, these are the different branches. If the people who can claim that their church is the original church, rightfully so, are these people. I had a person send me a blistering, scathing letter at my website a couple weeks ago because I said the Catholic Church is directly tied to the original church, unlike my church and most other people's churches. This person, you need to study history, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. I wrote back very politely and said, I did, actually. I think I know what I'm talking about. And I gave him lots and lots of reasons. All right. So you have Rome, which is very hierarchical and very interested in legal questions about salvation. You have Eastern Christianity, which is much more spiritual. Stresses much more mystical, stressing deification, becoming Christ-like. That's why Pelagius went to the East. He was accepted there. You have the Coptic Church, which more strongly emphasizes the deity of Christ than his humanity. We have the Nestorian Church, which is the polar opposite. The Nestorian Church was annihilated when the Muslims came. These other churches still exist. The Jacobites are kind of like Coptic for Syria. Okay, great. West falls apart, Gregory the Great, Church of the East, Advent of Islam, the falling apart of Rome, the degradation of the church. This person here, Hildebrand, Gregory the Seventh, this represents the peak of the power of the papacy, where the Pope was saying who's going to be king. The Pope had massive lands and this kind of stuff. Okay, got it. Then we talked about Reformation movements, attempts at reform during the Middle Ages. Let's see. Which one of these was successful in the sense that there are still people that can tie themselves back? Which one of these was the most successful? Right, the Waldensians. Well, in fact, when John Huss started his Reformation, there were Waldensians who kind of were incorporated into his movement. Okay? These are attempts to reform the Catholic Church. They would reject things like the papacy and sacramentalism and all these heteroprex things. Okay, Waldensians, just tens of thousands, some of them burned at the stake. The Albigensians are problematic. They had some really bizarre theology. I wouldn't suggest you become like them. All right, and then we spent some time talking about scholasticism. I think I can go through this stuff really fast. I don't think it's that relevant for us necessarily. All right, let's look at that slide really quickly. What name on there would I probably want you to be aware of as we move forward? There's one name on there that you
Aquinas.
Aquinas. Anselm came up with the ontological argument. Right. You know, I don't think I'm big on that one. Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas is the doctor of the Catholic Church. So the Roman Catholic Church is Thomian, or whatever you want to call it. They're not Augustinian anymore. All right, the Roman Catholic Church, for all practical purposes, abandoned Augustinianism. And with the Jesuits, they moved very, very strongly towards the idea of free will. All right? And there you go. Oh, Anselm, I believe that I may know. That's the Middle Age idea of how we know. We believe to know. And of course, after the Renaissance, we know in order to believe. That's kind of the idea of rationalism. Okay, Thomas Aquinas revived Aristotle. He had many arguments for the existence of God. He's arguing for free will here. He's saying God's sovereignty does not destroy our sovereignty. He says if God sovereignly chooses to make us sovereign, how's that make him any less sovereign than if he wasn't? In fact, he would argue if God makes us sovereign, that's even more sovereign. All right? And that's basically his argument. He believed in free will. All right. Occam, Francis of Assisi, that's awesome. The Dominicans, spiritual life in the late Middle Ages. All right. The biggest takeaway from practice in the late Middle Ages is the idea of purgatory. That was the dominant concept. It basically, for all practical purposes, Roman Catholicism was in awe about purgatory. In fact, you could argue the reason the Reformation happened was as a response principally to purgatory and the things that came from purgatory. All right, so let's remind ourselves then, what is purgatory?
It's
more than just a waiting place, because the Bible has a waiting place. Hades. It's a wait, and you can't do penance there. People do penance for you here. And so people lived in this permanent state of guilt. What about my uncle? What about my grandmother? So when they were giving indulgences, they were paying for their mother's salvation, not for their own. And this held tremendous power. I'm telling you, the monks held tremendous power, and the priests over the people. And it's a horrifying system. Horrifying. And all these things All these things here were designed to either limit your time in purgatory or to release other people from purgatory. Penances, masses. There were priests who all they did all day, 7 days a week, is say masses. And they would say, let's say, 20 masses in a day, and the only person in the room was the priest. This is crazy stuff. They would just blah, 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 you know, and just all this hocus pocus, diamond hocus stuff, and they'd do it time and time again because somebody paid them a bunch of money. People would leave their entire will to buy masses to free their souls from hell or other people's souls from hell. And the idea was, I mean, officially, the Catholic Church doesn't teach work salvation. I'm telling you right now, if you tell Catholics they teach work salvation, they will deny it to the death. But this whole system, it made a joke out of that. All right? It made an... Yeah?
Is there any... I know they didn't use much Bible, but is there any story in the Bible that maybe they used for the start of this process, or just kind of came out of thin air?
All right. Sort of a proof text for the idea of purgatory? Probably like the rich man in Lazarus or something like that. Probably, like, for example, it says he descended into hell, right? That's in the Nicene Creed or the Apostles' Creed. You know, so they would say he went into purgatory. And you know what? In fact, 1 Peter chapter 3, I have to admit, that was kind of a weird one, you know. He went and preached to the spirits in prison, you know. So I'm sure they would use that. You know, sorry for not having the immediate answer. I never really thought about that question. But I think...
He trash talked them.
Yeah. All right. Crusades, indulgences. Of course, you're probably aware of those famous 95 theses. We were talking earlier about feces. No, feces. Put your tongue in the right place there now, okay? Theses. That's going to be on the tape now. Oh, boy. It involved indulgences. By the way, indulgences are still accepted practice in Catholicism today. Now, it's not as blatant like you give $10,000 and you get this much time out of purgatory. You know, as the coins ring, the soul sings or something like that. But the idea of essentially making... you know, giving of yourself in some way to the church to release time from purgatory, that is still accepted doctrine of the Catholic Church. Okay, great. The Babylonian captivity of the church. This is some of the... I'm going to stop there. Okay, we talked about Wycliffe. Wycliffe's Reformation was... It didn't go as far as eventually, say, Calvin or Luther or Zwingli did, but really... he restored correct practice very, very dramatically. All right? And amazingly, he died peacefully. Of course, they later on dug up his bones and burned them at the stake and threw them in the river. But, all right, so this is the first successful, semi-successful Reformation in England. His followers were called Lollards. And there were still a few sort of kind of Lollard type people around when the English Reformation happened in the 16th century. This is in the 14th century, okay? The Wycliffites. Of course, he produced the first English translation of the Bible. It was from the Latin Vulgate. It was a very not a high quality translation. So it wasn't that relevant, but anyway, he did. John Huss. Actually, Wycliffe's Reformation was a more thorough one than that of John Huss. John Huss was trying to work as if he possibly could within the Catholic Church. This is occurring in Bohemia. We would call that the Czech Republic today. Okay. And the first crusade, or not the first crusade, but there was a massive crusade against the Hussites. It took them something like 25 years to finally completely destroy the Hussites and reabsorb them into the Catholic Church. The remnant groups that come from there are the Brethren and the Moravians. And we're going to learn about this guy, Zinzendorf. I don't think we get to him today. We'll get to him probably tomorrow. And the Moravian Church was the first Protestant church that began to actually do missionary work. But that was not until the 18th century. So the Brethren and Moravian Churches, these are small groups that still exist even today. Yes?
What is the communion of both kinds?
Ah, good. I'm glad you stopped me. So believe it or not, the Catholic Church only gave the bread, not the wine. I guess, Greg, do you know if the Catholics give wine now, or do they still
they
just...
Do. They do. After Vatican II.
Vatican II. Yeah. All the way up into Vatican II, like the 60s. Because they figured that they didn't want to risk somebody spilling Jesus' blood. If they dropped his body, they could pick it up and still eat it. But if they spilled his blood, they couldn't. So because of the idea of transubstantiation, only the priests could take the wine.
But it was also a part of their manipulation. They withheld the cup for the real special occasions. You had to pay extra.
Yeah. Anyway, but Hus returned, and interesting because they eventually became the Uniate Church. So when they reincorporated Hus's group back into the Catholic Church, they allowed them to have a special dispensation to still do the Lord's Supper in both kinds. And for hundreds of years, the former Hussite branch of the Catholic Church was able to do communion in both kinds. All right, John Hus burned at the stake. Byzantium falls. Here we go. Yay! How long have I been going? I have no idea.
37 minutes.
How long?
37 minutes.
All right, so I guess I'll start then. I'll just barely start our class. All right. I don't know why I put this slide on first, but I guess it'll kind of give you a feeling for where we're going. So this picture essentially illustrates the result, if you will, of the Protestant Reformation. So the Protestant Reformation produced Lutheran lands. It produced Calvinist or Reformed churches. And, of course, it left behind a massive Catholic church. See those little dots? That's the Huguenots. That's the French Calvinists who never controlled the territory. They never did. But there were many, many Calvinists within France. All right, and then of course this represents the English church, which was neither Calvinist nor Lutheran. They were kind of a bizarre hybrid, probably more Calvinist than Lutheran eventually, but especially after the English Revolution. But anyway, so you're going to eventually have Calvinist territories, you're going to have Lutheran territories, and you're going to have Catholic territories. Okay, this is. In 1507, after the Counter-Reformation, when basically the Catholic Church won back a fair amount of the land that had been won to Lutheranism. Okay, got it? Great. So let's do the background. Let's summarize the situation in the year AD 1500. The power of the papacy is on the decline already. And by 1500, we've gone into the period known as the Renaissance. And during the Renaissance, what happened was there was a lot more emphasis on the individual, a lot less emphasis on the community. And so nations, these nation states began to have much power. Before that time, the nation of France was a small state. And there's all these other little states, and there were church states in there. There was Burgundy, and there's all these other things. And during this time, England became a powerful nation. Spain became a powerful nation. All right, and all that. So the power of the papacy was reduced, and nation states had greater power. Of course, there were a number of sort of semi-failed attempts at reform. People were aware of that. There was a general feeling everywhere in Catholicism that reform was needed. So the first thing we're going to talk about is the Catholic Reformation. Not the Protestant Reformation. And an interesting thought is, if the printing press had not been invented, would there have ever even been a Protestant Reformation? Or might the Catholic Church have been reformed sufficiently through the efforts that were happening during the Catholic Reformation so that a Protestant Reformation never would have happened. And what would history be like? What would history be like if there not been a Protestant Reformation? That is a very interesting thing to contemplate. Like I said, the dominating religious, the factor in the religious life of the average Christian under Christendom under in the papacy was purgatory. All right? By this time, the papacy was not as corrupt as it had been 200 or 300 years before. There had been a number of attempts at reform, and some of those forms had somewhat improved the moral character of the papacy. All right, so having hundreds of children and being at the head of armies, the kind of incredibly corrupt practices in the 12th, 13th, and 14th century. Believe it or not, in the year 1500, from a moral perspective, the church was actually in a better place than it had been earlier due to some reforms that had happened due to the consular movement. Nevertheless, the church reigned supreme, obviously. Purgatory was there. And although the church wasn't quite as morally corrupt, it was extremely wealthy. In places like England, the church owned as much as 30% of the entire land in England. So this created a problem because what you have is a powerful nation state in England, and yet this power way over here owns so much of the land. And you might remember that was part of what when Wycliffe had his Reformation, that was part of the issue that was going on there. All right, this, again, more of the background here. It's also when Europe began to enter the modern age. So you've got the Renaissance, but you also have Europe breaking out, right? 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Actually, more significant for Europe was what Vasco da Gama did. Vasco da Gama, who cleared the Cape of Good Hope and opened up the vast wealth of Asia to Europe. Because before then, the Muslim powers had full control. There was just no way for any European to get to Asia because there was an entire barrier of Muslim lands. So at this time, this is when Europe began to have vast wealth. The Spanish Empire opens up. The Portuguese Empire opens up. This is very significant. It's also when the scientific revolution began. Now, modernism doesn't begin in 1500. Modernism begins closer to, in the 17th century. But the things that led to modernism are happening at this time. On the one hand, and in the year 1500, Europe is moving to the West. It's the New World. Vast wealth is being opened up to Christian powers. But in Central Europe, the Ottoman Empire practically conquered the entire continent of Europe. In fact, Suleiman the Magnificent, his troops went right up to the wall of Vienna. If you look at a map of Europe, so the Muslim powers appeared, at least from the land war perspective, it could very well have conquered entire Christendom. It came fairly close to doing that. So this created a fair amount of depression or discouragement about this given system there. All right. Another huge factor is the invention of the printing press. By the way, Gutenberg did not invent the printing press. He reinvented it. The printing press was invented in China, moving type, but for all practical purposes, he reinvented it. And you could argue that Luther could have never, ever even possibly have done what he did if it were not for the printing press, as we get to talking about Luther. Okay. Good. Any questions so far? Questions, thoughts, reactions? Okay. Now, I want to talk about the Catholic Reformation. You have to understand that Catholics everywhere realized their church was in big trouble. All right? And they understood that the church had way too much power, that especially the orders of monks were extremely corrupt. So there was a general understanding that reform was needed. The most well-known reformer of that period is this guy named Erasmus. Have you all heard of Erasmus before? Desiderius Erasmus. He was the greatest scholar of the Renaissance, probably. Now, we have greater artists, for sure, and maybe Da Vinci, but Da Vinci wasn't so much of a scholar. He was more like an engineer, an artist. So, Erasmus, he's part of what's known as the Northern Renaissance. So the Southern Renaissance happened primarily in Italy. So you've got Michelangelo and Da Vinci and Plutarch and all these things. The Italian Renaissance happened in the 15th century. Okay? In fact, by 1517, we've passed the peak of the Italian Southern Renaissance, but this is the time of what's known as the Northern Renaissance. So this is when universities are being opened all over Northern Europe, in Holland, in Belgium, in England, in Germany, in Poland. All right. So the Renaissance came almost 100 years later to Northern Europe, and the Northern Renaissance was far more religious. The Southern Renaissance was more humanistic. It was more individualistic, more open-minded. The Northern Renaissance was a much more of a religious sort of thing. All right? And so we have the chief figure in the Northern Renaissance, and his name is Desiderius Erasmus. Here's a quote I like from Erasmus. He said, "Scripture reveals the living image of Christ's holy mind and of Christ himself speaking, healing, dying, and rising." Erasmus loved the Bible. His two greatest loves were the Greek language and the Bible. And he wanted to restore Christianity to its biblical, pristine state. There were many, many Catholics who wanted to do this. They didn't want to start a new church. Guess who else didn't want to start a new church? His name was Martin Luther. In fact, Martin Luther and Erasmus have a lot in common. But Luther was an anti-intellectual. All right, and Erasmus is an intellectual. And ultimately, Erasmus turned against Luther, primarily because Luther was an anti-intellectual, and he was scared to death of that. Because the thing he was trying to save was the humanities, essentially, the beautiful humanities. He was a humanist, but he was a Christian humanist. You can be a humanist and a Christian, believe it or not. Back in the 60s and the 70s, the sort of conservative churches, humanism is the enemy of Christianity. Well, okay, I guess. Maybe not. One of his famous books was In Praise of Folly. And he blistered the monks in their hypocrisy and their foolish religious practices and pilgrimages and monasticism. And by the way, he himself was a monk, and he hated being in the monastery. He did everything he could possibly do to get out of the monastery, and he finally escaped because what he wanted to be was a scholar. He wanted to be a Greek and Latin scholar, and he got his wish. It's in my book. I'm sure it's there. All right. It was a very, very conservative. It was a highly ascetic order of monks. Yeah.
So, correct me if I'm wrong. When it came to the Renaissance, wasn't the cultural feel at that time like trying to get back to the glory of Rome? Like that was in a lot of art of the time. Was like Rome was kind of this golden, you know, light on the hill. Like, oh, if we could only get back there. Did that have anything to do with the Reformation, them looking at the church and comparing it to the ancient, you know, kind of the height of it when it was...
Yeah, but Scholasticism was about getting back to Rome as well. Yeah. But Scholasticism was about getting back to Rome kind of up here in the mind. And the Renaissance was it was more of an aesthetic thing, especially the Southern Renaissance. So getting back to the art and music, not necessarily the philosophy of Greece was already, you know, brought back into play through Aquinas and others and Anselm. So yes, definitely yes, but it was about more the aesthetics of Rome and Greece than maybe the philosophy of Rome and Greece. Yeah. Luther was definitely Augustinian. It wouldn't be at all surprising if he was Augustinian, because the Augustinians, we're going to see Luther had very, very harsh ascetic practices. Okay, yeah. Very harsh.
He's Augustinian.
All right. Yeah, and definitely, I mean, Erasmus ended up in totally the wrong order.
Yeah.
Totally. Totally. It was an anti-intellectual order, and he finally was actually officially absolved of being in that order, like 40 years later or something like that. Okay, great. He entered a monastery. He hated it. He studied Greek. Let me see. I think I've been going over 50 minutes now. Yes? All right. I'd say it's a good time to take a break. So, take a break.
Hey, John, when will part four be done?
In 3 years, maybe? Each volume takes about 3 years.
Great. Can't wait 3 years.
Don't hold your breath, though, right?